The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the seventh reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. Henri paints the bicycle and Isabelle uses it to deliver the tracts. Henri asks her to go to Paris and deliver a letter to a man who seeks to organize a free French movement. Isabelle agrees and travels to Paris and her father's apartment. Next day, she sets out on her mission. When she reached the Rue de Rivoli, black cars and green military lorries with fuel tanks strapped onto their sides and men on horseback filled the street. There were Parisians about, walking along the sidewalks, pedaling down the few streets upon which they were allowed to ride, queuing for food in lines that extended down the block. They were noticeable by the look of defeat on their faces and the way they hurried past the Germans without making eye contact. At Maxime's restaurant, beneath the famous red awning, she saw a cluster of high-ranking Nazis waiting to get inside. The rumor was rampant that all of the country's best meats and produce went straight to Maxime's to be served to the high command. And then she spotted it, the iron bench near the entrance to the Comédie Française. Isabelle hit the brakes on her bicycle and came to a bumpy, sudden stop, then stepped off the pedal with one foot. Her ankle gave a little twist when she put her weight on it. For the first time, her excitement turned a little sharp with fear. Her handbag felt heavy suddenly, noticeably so. Sweat collected in her palms and along the rim of her felt hat. Snap out of it. She was a courier, not a frightened schoolgirl. What risk there was, she accepted. While she stood there, a woman approached the bench and sat down with her back to Isabelle. A woman. She hadn't expected her contact to be a woman, but that was strangely comforting. She took a deep, calming breath and walked her bicycle across the busy crosswalk and past the kiosks with their scarves and trinkets for sale. When she was directly beside the woman on the bench, she said what she'd been told to say. "Do you think I'll need an umbrella today?" "I expect it to remain sunny." The woman turned. She had dark hair, which she'd coiled away from her face with care, and bold Eastern European features. She was older, maybe 30, but the look in her eyes was even older. Isabelle started to open her handbag when the woman said, "No," sharply. "Then follow me," she said, rising quickly. Isabelle remained behind the woman as she made her way across the wide, gravelly expanse of the Cour Napoléon, with the mammoth elegance of the Louvre rising majestically around them. Although it didn't feel like a place that had once been a palace of emperors and kings, not with swastika flags everywhere and German soldiers sitting on benches in the Tuileries garden. On a side street, the woman ducked into a small cafe. Isabelle locked her bicycle to a tree out front and followed her inside, taking a seat across from her. "You have the envelope?" Isabelle nodded. In her lap, she opened her handbag and withdrew the envelope, which she handed to the woman beneath the table. A pair of German officers walked into the bistro, took a table not far away. The woman leaned over and straightened Isabelle's beret. It was a strangely intimate gesture, as if they were sisters or best friends. Leaning close, the woman whispered in her ear, "Have you heard of Les Colobos?" "No." "Collaborators, French men and women who are working with the Germans. They are not only in Vichy. Be aware, always. These collaborators love to report us to the Gestapo. And once they know your name, the Gestapo are always watching. Trust no one." She nodded. The woman drew back and looked at her. "Not even your father." "How do you know about my father?" "We want to meet you." "You just have." "We," she said quietly, "stand at the corner of Boulevard Saint-Germain and Rue de Saint-Simon tomorrow at noon. Do not be late. Do not bring your bicycle. And do not be followed." Isabelle was surprised by how quickly the woman got to her feet. In an instant, she was gone, and Isabelle was at the café table alone, under the watchful eye of the German soldier at the other table. She forced herself to order a café au lait, although she knew there would be no milk and the coffee would be chicory. Finishing it quickly, she exited the cafe. At the corner, she saw a sign pasted to the window that warned of executions in retaliation for infractions. Beside it, in the cinema window, was a yellow poster that read, "Interdit aux Juifs, no Jews allowed." As she unlocked her bicycle, the German soldier appeared beside her. She bumped into him. He asked solicitously if she was all right. Her answer was an actress's smile and a nod. "Mais oui, merci." She smoothed her dress and clamped her purse in her armpit and climbed onto the bicycle. She pedaled away from the soldier without looking back. She had done it. She had gotten an Ausweis and came to Paris and forced her papa to let her stay, and she had delivered her first secret message for the Free French. Chapter 16. Vianne had to admit that life at Le Jardin was easier without Isabel. No more outbursts, no more veiled comments made just within Captain Beck's earshot, no more pushing Vianne to wage useless battles in a war already lost. Still, sometimes, without Isabel, the house was too quiet, and in the silence, Vianne found herself thinking too loudly, like now. She'd been awake for hours, just staring at her own bedroom ceiling, waiting for the dawn. Finally, she got out of bed and went downstairs. She poured herself a cup of bitter made from acorns coffee and took it out into the backyard, where she sat on the chair that had been Antoine's favorite, beneath the sprawling branches of the yew tree, listening to the chickens scratching lethargically through the dirt. Her money was all but gone. They would now have to live on her meager teaching salary. How was she to do it, and alone? She finished her coffee, as terrible as it was. Carrying the empty cup back into the shadowy, already warming house, she saw the door to Captain Beck's bedroom was open. He had left for the day while she was out back. Good. She woke Sophie, listened to the story of her latest dream, and made her a breakfast of dried toast and peach jam. Then the two of them headed for town. Vianne rushed Sophie as much as possible, but Sophie was in a foul mood and complained and dragged her feet. Thus it was late afternoon by the time they reached the butcher's shop. There was a queue that snaked out the door and down the street. Vianne took her place at the end and glanced nervously at the Germans in the square. The queue shuffled forward. At the display window, Vianne noticed a new propaganda poster that showed a smiling German soldier offering bread to a group of French children, because it was a new sign that read, "No Jews allowed." "What does that mean, maman?" Sophie said, pointing to the sign. "Hush, Sophie," Vianne said sharply. "We have talked about this. Some things are no longer spoken of." "But Father Joseph says..." "Hush," Vianne said impatiently, giving Sophie's hand a tug for emphasis. The queue moved forward. Vianne stepped to the front and found herself staring at a gray-haired woman with skin the color and texture of oatmeal. Vianne frowned. "Where is Madame Fournier?" she asked, offering her ration ticket for today's meat. She hoped there was still some to be had. "No Jews allowed," the woman said. "We have a little smoked pigeon left." "But this is the Fournier shop." "Not anymore. It's mine now. You want the pigeon or not?" Vianne took the small tin of smoked pigeon and dropped it in her willow basket. Saying nothing, she led Sophie outside. On the opposite corner, a German sentry stood guard in front of the bank, reminding the French people that the bank had been seized by the Germans. "Maman," Sophie whined, "it's wrong to..." "Hush!" Vianne grabbed Sophie's hand. As they walked out of town and along the dirt road home, Sophie made her displeasure known. She huffed and sighed and grumbled. Vianne ignored her. When they reached the broken gate to Le Jardin, Sophie yanked free and spun to face Vianne. "How can they just take the butcher's shop? Tante Isabel would do something. You're just afraid." "And what should I do? Storm into the square and demand that Madame Fournier get her shop back? And what would they do to me for that? You've seen the posters in town." She lowered her voice. "They're executing French people, Sophie. Executing them." "No buts. These are dangerous times, Sophie. You need to understand that." Sophie's eyes glazed with tears. "I wish Papa were here." Vianne pulled her daughter into her arms and held her tightly. Me too. They held each other for a long time and then slowly separated. We are going to make pickles today. How about that? Oh, fun. Vianne couldn't disagree. Why don't you go pick cucumbers? I'll get the vinegar started. Vianne watched her daughter run ahead, dodging through the heavily laden apple trees toward the garden. The moment she disappeared, Vianne's worry returned. What would she do without money? The garden was producing well, so there would be fruit and vegetables, but what about the coming winter? How could Sophie stay healthy without meat or milk or cheese? How would they get new shoes? She was shaking as she made her way into the hot, blacked-out house. In the kitchen, she clutched the counter's edge and bowed her head. Madame? She turned so fast she almost tripped over her own feet. He was in the living room, sitting on the divan with an oil lamp lit beside him, reading a book. Captain Beck, she said his name quietly. She moved toward him, her shaking hands clasped together. Your motorcycle is not out front. It was such a beautiful day, I decided to walk from town. He rose. She saw that he had recently had a haircut and that he'd nicked himself shaving this morning. A tiny red cut marred his pale cheek. You look upset. Perhaps it is because you have not been sleeping well since your sister left? She looked at him in surprise. I hear you walking around in the dark. You're awake, too, she said stupidly. I often cannot sleep either. I think of my wife and children. My son is so young, I wonder if he will know me at all. I think the same about Antoine, she said, surprising herself with the admission. She knew she shouldn't be so open with this man, the enemy. But just now she was too tired and scared to be strong. Beck stared down at her, and in his eyes she saw the loss they shared. Both of them were a long way from the people they loved and lonelier for it. Well, I mean not to intrude on your day, of course, but I have some news for you. With much research, I have discovered that your husband is in an Auflage in Germany. A friend of mine is a guard there. Your husband is an officer. Did you know this? No doubt he was valiant on the battlefield. You found Antoine? He's alive? He held out a crumple-stained envelope. Here is a letter he has written to you, and now you may send him care packages, which I believe would cheer him most immeasurably. Oh, my! She felt her legs weaken. He grasped her, steadied her, and led her over to the divan. As she slumped to the seat, she felt tears welling in her eyes. Such a kind thing to do, she whispered, taking the letter from him, pressing it to her chest. My friend delivered the letter to me. From now on, my apologies, you will correspond on the postcards only. He smiled at her, and she had the strangest feeling that he knew about the lengthy letters she concocted in her head at night. Merci, she said, wishing it weren't such a small word. Au revoir, madame, he said, then turned on his heel and left her alone. The crumpled, dirty letter shook in her grasp. The letters of her name blurred and danced as she opened it. Vianne, my beloved, first, do not worry about me. I am safe and fed well enough. I am unhurt. Truly, no bullet holes in me. In the barracks, I have been lucky enough to claim an upper bunk, and it gives me some privacy in a place of too many men. Through a small window, I can see the moon at night and the spires of Nuremberg. But it is the moon that makes me think of you. Our food is enough to sustain us. I have grown used to pellets of flour and small pieces of potato. When I get home, I look forward to your cooking. I dream of it, and you and Sophie all the time. Please, my beloved, don't fret. Just stay strong and be there for me when the time comes for me to leave this cage. You are my sunlight in the dark and the ground beneath my feet. Because of you, I can survive. I hope that you can find strength in me, too, V. That because of me, you will find a way to be strong. Hold my daughter tightly tonight and tell her that somewhere far away, her papa is thinking of her, and tell her I will return. I love you, Vianne. P.S. The Red Cross is delivering packages. If you could send me my hunting gloves, I would be very happy. The winters here are cold. Vianne finished the letter and immediately began reading it again. Exactly a week after her arrival in Paris, Isabel was to meet the others who shared her passion for a free France. and she was nervous as she walked among the sallow-faced Parisians and well-fed Germans toward an unknown destination. She had dressed carefully this morning, in a fitted blue rayon dress with a black belt. She'd set her hair last night and combed it out in precise waves this morning, pinning it back from her face. She wore no makeup. An old convent school blue beret and white gloves completed the outfit. "I am an actress, and this is a role," she thought as she walked down the street. "I am a schoolgirl in love, sneaking out to meet a boy." That was the story she decided on and dressed for. She was sure that, if questioned, she could make a German believe her. With all of the barricaded streets, it took her longer than expected to arrive at her destination, but finally she ducked around a barricade and moved onto the Boulevard Saint-Germain. She stood beneath a street lamp. Behind her, traffic moved slowly up the boulevard, horns honking, motors grumbling, horse hooves clomping, bicycle bells ringing. Even with all that noise, this once lively street felt stripped of its life and color. A police wagon pulled up alongside of her, and a gendarme stepped out of the vehicle, his cloak folded over his shoulders. He was carrying a white stick. "Do you think I'll need an umbrella today?" Isabel jumped, made a little sound. She'd been so focused on the policeman, he was crossing the street now, heading toward a woman coming out of a cafe, that she'd forgotten her mission. I expected to remain sunny," she said. The man clutched her upper arm. There was no other word for it, really. He had a tight grip and led her down the suddenly empty street. It was funny how one police wagon could make Parisians disappear. No one stuck around for an arrest, neither to witness it nor to help. Isabel tried to see the man beside her, but they were moving too fast. She glimpsed his boots, slashing quickly across the sidewalk beneath them. Old leather, torn laces, a hole emerging from scuff marks at the left toe. "Close your eyes," he said as they crossed the street. "Why?" "Do it." She was not one to follow orders blindly, a quip she might have made under other circumstances. But she wanted so badly to be a part of this that she did as instructed. She closed her eyes and stumbled along beside him, almost tripping over her own feet more than once. At last they came to a stop. She heard him knock four times on a door. Then there were footsteps, and she heard the whoosh of a door opening, and the acrid smell of cigarette smoke wafted across her face. It occurred to her now, just this instant, that she could be in danger. The man pulled her inside, and the door slammed shut behind them. Isabel opened her eyes, even though she had not been told to do so. Best that she show her mettle now. The room didn't come into focus instantly. It was dark, the air thick with cigarette smoke. All of the windows were blacked out. The only light came from two oil lamps sputtering valiantly against the shadows and smoke. Three men sat at a wooden table that bore an overflowing ashtray. Two were young, wearing patched coats and ragged pants. Between them sat a pencil-thin old man with a wax-gray mustache, whom she recognized. Standing at the back wall was the woman who had been Isabel's contact. She was dressed all in black, like a widow, and was smoking a cigarette. "Monsieur Levy?" Isabel asked the older man. "Is that you?" He pulled the tattered beret from his shiny, bald head and held it in his clasped hands. "Isabel Rosenau." "You know this woman?" one of the men asks. "I was a regular patron of her father's bookshop," Levy said. "Last I heard, she was impulsive, undisciplined, and charming. How many schools expelled you, Isabel?" "One too many," my father would say. "But what good is knowing where to seat an ambassador's second son at a dinner party these days?" Isabel said. "I am still charming, and still outspoken." "A rash head and thoughtless words could get everyone in this room killed," he said carefully. Isabel understood her mistake instantly. She nodded. "You are very young," the woman in the back said, exhaling smoke. "Not anymore," Isabel said. "I dress to look younger today. I think it is an asset. Who would suspect a 19-year-old girl of anything illegal? And you, of all people, should know that a woman can do anything a man can do." Monsieur Levy sat back in his chair and studied her. "A friend recommends you highly." Henri. He tells us you have been distributing out tracks for months, and Anouk says you were quite steady yesterday. Isabel glanced at the woman, Anouk, who nodded in response. I will do anything to help our cause, Isabel said. Her chest felt tight with anticipation. It had never occurred to her that she could come all this way and be denied entrance to this network of people whose cause was her own. At last, Monsieur Levy said, you will need false papers, a new identity. We will get that for you, but it will take some time. Isabel drew in a sharp breath. She had been accepted. A sense of destiny seemed to fill the room. She would do something that mattered now. She knew it. For now, the Nazis are so arrogant, they do not believe that any kind of resistance can succeed against them, Levy said. But they will see, and then the danger to all of us will increase. You must tell no one of your association with us, no one, and that includes your family. It is for their safety and your own. It would be easy for Isabel to hide her activities. No one cared particularly where she went or what she did. Oui, she said. So, what do I do? Anouk pulled away from the wall and crossed the room, stepping over the stack of terrorist papers that were on the floor. Isabel couldn't see the headline clearly. It was something about the RAF bombing of Hamburg and Berlin. She reached into her pocket and pulled out a small package about the size of a deck of cards, wrapped in crinkled tan-colored paper and tied up with twine. You will deliver this to the Tabac in the old quarter in Amboise, the one directly below the chateau. It must arrive no later than tomorrow, 4 p.m. She handed Isabel the package and one half of a torn 5-franc note. Offer him the note. If he shows you another half, give him the package. Leave then. Do not look back. Do not speak to him. As she took the package and the note, she heard a sharp, short knock on the door behind her. An instant tension tightened the air in the room. Glances were exchanged. Isabel was reminded keenly that this was dangerous work. It could be a policeman on the other side of the door, or a Nazi. Three knocks followed. Monsieur Levy nodded evenly. The door opened, and in walked a fat man with an egg-shaped head and an age-spotted face. I found him wandering around, the old man said as he stepped aside to reveal an RAF pilot still in his flight suit. Mon Dieu, Isabel whispered. Anouk nodded glumly. They are everywhere, Anouk said under her breath, falling from the skies. She smiled tightly at the joke. Evaders, escapees from German prison, downed airmen. Isabel stared at the airmen. Everyone knew the penalty for helping British airmen. It was announced on billboards all over town. Imprisonment or death. Get some clothes, Levy said. The old man turned to the airmen and began speaking. Clearly, the airmen didn't speak French. They are going to get you some clothes, Isabel said. The room fell silent. She felt everyone looking at her. You speak English, Anouk said quietly. Passably, 2 years in a Swiss finishing school. Another silence fell. Then Levy said, tell the pilot we will put him in hiding until we can find a way out of France for him. You can do that, Isabel said. Not at present, Anouk said. Don't tell him that, of course. Just tell him we are on his side and he is safe, relatively, and he is to do as he is told. Isabel went to the airman. As she neared him, she saw the scratches on his face and the way something had torn the sleeve of his flight suit. She was pretty sure dried blood darkened his hairline, and she thought, he dropped bombs on Germany. Not all of us are passive, she said to the young man. You speak English, he said. Thank God. My airplane crashed 4 days ago. I've been crouching in dark corners ever since. I didn't know where to go till this man grabbed me and dragged me here. You will help me? She nodded. How? Can you get me back home? I don't have the answers. Just do as they tell you. And, monsieur? Yes, ma'am? They are risking their lives to help you. You understand that? He nodded. Isabel turned to face her new colleagues. He understands and will do as you ask. Merci, Isabel, Levy said. Where do we contact you after your return from Amboise? The moment she heard the question, Isabel had an answer that surprised her. The bookshop, she said firmly. I am going to reopen it. Levy gave her a look. What will your father say about that? I thought he closed it when the Nazis told him what to sell. My father works for the Nazis, she said bitterly. His opinions don't account for much. He asked me to get a job. This will be my job. I will be accessible to all of you at any time. It is the perfect solution. It is, Levy said, although it sounded as if he didn't agree. Very well, then. Anouk will bring you new papers as soon as we can get a carte d'identité made. We will need a photograph of you. His gaze narrowed. And Isabel, allow me to be an old man for a moment and to remind a young girl who is used to being impulsive that there can be none of that anymore. You know I am friends with your father, or I was until he showed his true colors, and I have heard stories about you for years. It is time for you to grow up and do as you are told, always, without exception. It is for your safety as much as ours. It embarrassed Isabel that he felt the need to say this to her, and in front of everyone. Of course. And if you get caught, Anouk said, it will be as a woman. You understand? They have special unpleasantries for us. Isabel swallowed hard. She had thought, briefly, of imprisonment and execution. This was something she had never even considered. Of course she should have. What we all demand of each other, or hope for at any rate, is 2 days. 2 days? If you are captured and questioned, try to say nothing for 2 days. That gives us time to disappear. 2 days, Isabel said. That's not so long. You are so young, Anouk said, frowning. In the past 6 days, Isabel had left Paris 4 times. She'd delivered packages in Amboise, Blois, and Lyon. She'd spent more time in train stations than in her father's apartment, an arrangement that suited them both. As long as she stood in food queues during the day and returned home before the curfew, her father didn't care what she did. Now, though, she was back in Paris and ready to move forward with the next phase of her plan. You are not reopening the bookshop. Isabel stared at her father. He stood near the blacked-out window. In the pale light, the apartment looked shabbily grand, decorated as it was with ornate antiques collected over the generations. Good paintings in heavy gilt frames graced the walls. Some were missing, and black shadows hung on the wall in their place. Probably Papa had sold them. And if the blackout shades could be lifted, a breathtaking view of the Eiffel Tower lay just beyond their balcony. You told me to get a job, she said stubbornly. The paper-wrapped package in her handbag gave her a new strength with her father. Besides, he was already half-drunk. In no time, he'd be sprawled in the bergère in the salon, whimpering in his sleep. When she was a girl, those sad sounds he made in his sleep had made her long to comfort him. No more. I meant a paid job, he said dryly. He poured himself another snifter of brandy. Why don't you just use a soup bowl, she said. He ignored that. I won't have it. That's all. You will not open the bookshop. I have already done it. Today I was there cleaning all afternoon. He seemed to go still, his bushy gray eyebrows raised into his lined brow. You cleaned? I cleaned, she said. I know it surprises you, Papa, but I am not 12 years old. She moved toward him. I am doing this, Papa. I have decided. It will allow me time to queue up for food and a chance to make some small bit of money. The Germans will buy books for me. I promise you that. You'll flirt with them, he said. She felt the sting of his judgment. Says the man who works for them. He stared at her. She stared at him. Fine, he said at last. You'll do what you will, but the storeroom in back, that's mine. Mine, Isabel. I will lock it up and take the key, and you will respect my wishes by staying out of that room. Why? It doesn't matter why. Do you have assignations with women in there, on the sofa? He shook his head. You are a foolish girl. Thank God your maman did not live to see who you have become. Isabel hated how deeply that hurt her. Or you, Papa, she said. Or you. Chapter 17. In mid-June of 1941, on the second to the last school day of the term, Vianne was at the blackboard, conjugating a verb, when she heard the now familiar put-put-put of a German motorcycle. Soldiers again, Gilles Fournier said bitterly. The boy was always angry lately, and who could blame him? The Nazis had seized his family's butcher shop and given it to a collaborator. "Stay here," she said to her students, and went out into the hallway. In walked two men, a Gestapo officer in a long black coat and the local gendarme, Paul, who had gained weight since his collaboration with the Nazis. His stomach strained at his belt. How many times had she seen him strolling down Rue Victor Hugo, carrying more food than his family could eat, while she stood in a lengthy queue, clutching a ration card that would provide too little? Vianne moved toward them, her hands clasped tightly at her waist. She felt self-conscious in her threadbare dress with its frayed collar and cuffs, and although she had carefully drawn a brown seam line up the back of her bare calves, it was obvious that it was a ruse. She had no stockings on, and that made her feel strangely vulnerable to these men. On either side of the hallway, classroom doors opened, and teachers stepped out to see what the officers wanted. They made eye contact with one another, but no one spoke. The Gestapo agent walked determinedly toward Monsieur Peretsky's classroom at the end of the building. Fat Paul struggled to keep up, huffing along behind him. Moments later, Monsieur Peretsky was dragged out of his classroom by the French policeman. Vianne frowned as they passed her. Old man Peretsky, who had taught her sums a lifetime ago, and whose wife tended to the school's flowers, gave her a terrified look. "Paul," Vianne said sharply, "what is happening?" The policeman stopped. "He is accused of something." "I did nothing wrong," Peretsky cried, trying to pull free of Paul's grasp. The Gestapo agent noticed the commotion and perked up. He came at Vianne fast, heels clicking on the floor. She felt a shiver of fear at the glint in his eyes. "Madame, what is your reason for stopping us?" He is a friend of mine." "Really?" he said, drawing length from the word, making it a question. "So you know that he is distributing anti-German propaganda?" "It's a newspaper," Peretsky said. "I'm just telling the French people the truth. Vianne, tell them." Vianne felt attention turn to her. "Your name?" the Gestapo demanded, opening a notebook and taking out a pencil. She wet her lips nervously. "Vianne Mauriac." He wrote it down. "And you work with Monsieur Peretsky distributing flyers?" "No," she cried out. "He is a teaching colleague, sir. I know nothing about anything else." The Gestapo closed the notebook. "Has no one told you that it is best to ask no questions?" "I didn't mean to," she said, her throat dry. He gave a slow smile. It frightened her, disarmed her, that smile, enough so that it took her a minute to register his next words. "You are terminated, madame." Her heart seemed to stop. "Excuse me? I speak of your employment as a teacher. You are terminated. Go home, madame, and do not return. These students do not need an example such as you." At the end of the day, Vianne walked home with her daughter and even remembered now and then to answer one of Sophie's nonstop questions. But all the while she was thinking, what now? What now? The stalls and shops were closed this time of day, their bins and cases empty. There were signs everywhere saying, "No eggs, no butter, no oil, no lemons, no shoes, no thread, no paper bags." She had been frugal with the money Antoine left for her, more than frugal, miserly, even though it had seemed like so much money in the beginning. She had used it for necessities only, wood, electricity, gas, food, but still it was gone. How would she and Sophie survive without her salary from teaching? At home, she moved in a daze. She made a pot of cabbage soup and loaded it up with shredded carrots that were soft as noodles. As soon as the meal was finished, she did laundry, and when it was hanging out on the line, she darned socks until night fell. Too early, she shuffled a whiny, complaining Sophie off to bed. Alone, and feeling it like a knife pressed to her throat, she sat down at the dining table with an official postcard and a fountain pen. "Dearest Antoine, we are out of money and I have lost my job. What am I to do? Winter is only months away." She lifted the pen from the paper. The blue words seemed to expand against the white paper. Out of money. What kind of woman was she to even think of sending a letter like this to her prisoner of war husband? She balled up the postcard and threw it into the cold, soot-caked fireplace, where it lay all alone, a white ball on a bed of gray ash. No, it couldn't be in the house. What if Sophie found it, read it? She retrieved it from the ashes and carried it out to the backyard, where she threw it into the pergola. The chickens would trample and peck it to death. Outside, she sat down in Antoine's favorite chair, feeling dazed by the suddenness of her changed circumstances and this new and terrible fear. If only she could do it all over again. She'd spend even less money. She'd go without more. She'd let them take Monsieur Peretsky without a word. Behind her, the door creaked open and clicked shut. Footsteps, breathing. She should get up and leave, but she was too tired to move. Beck came up behind her. Would you care for a glass of wine? It's a Chateau Margaux 28, a very good year, apparently. Wine. She wanted to say yes, please. Perhaps she'd never needed a glass more, but she couldn't do it. Neither could she say no, so she said nothing. She heard the thunk of a cork being freed, and then the gurgle of wine being poured. He set a full glass on the table beside her. The sweet, rich scent was intoxicating. He poured himself a glass and sat down in the chair beside her. "I am leaving," he said after a long silence. She turned to him. "Do not look so eager. It is only for a while, a few weeks. I have not been home in 2 years." He took a drink. "My wife may be sitting in our garden right now, wondering who will return to her. I am not the man who left, alas. I have seen things." He paused. "This war, it is not as I expected, and things change in an absence this long. Do you not agree?" "Oui," she said. She had often thought the same thing. In the silence between them, she heard a frog croak and the leaves fluttering in a jasmine-scented breeze above their heads. A nightingale sang a sad and lonely song. "You do not seem yourself, madame," he said, "if you do not mind me saying so. I was fired from my teaching position today." It was the first time she'd said the words aloud, and they caused hot tears to glaze her eyes. "I drew attention to myself. A dangerous thing to do. The money my husband left is gone. I am unemployed, and winter will soon be upon us. How am I to survive, to feed Sophie and keep her warm?" She turned to look at him. Their gazes came together. She wanted to look away, but couldn't. He placed the wine glass in her hand, forced her fingers to coil around it. His touch felt hot against her cold hands, made her shiver. She remembered his office suddenly, and all that food stacked within it. "It is just wine," he said again, "and the scent of it, of black cherries and dark, rich earth and a hint of lavender, wafted up to her nose, reminding her of the life she'd had before, the nights she and Antoine had sat out here, drinking wine." She took a sip and gasped. She'd forgotten the simple pleasure. "You are beautiful, madame," he said, his voice as sweet and rich as the wine. "Perhaps it has been too long since you heard that." Vianne got to her feet so fast she knocked into the table and spilled the wine. "You should not say such things, Herr Captain." "No," he said, rising to his feet. He stood in front of her, his breath scented by red wine and spearmint gum. "I should not." "Please," she said, unable even to finish the sentence. "Your daughter will not starve this winter, madame," he said, softly, as if it were their secret accord. "That is one thing you can be sure of." God help Vianne, it relieved her. She mumbled something, she wasn't even sure what, and went back into the house, where she climbed into bed with Sophie, but it was a long time before she slept. The bookshop had once been a gathering place for poets and writers and novelists and academics. Isabel's best childhood memories took place in these musty rooms, while Papa had worked in the back room on his printing press. Maman had read Isabel's stories and fables and made up plays for them to act out. They had been happy here for a time, before Maman took sick and Papa started drinking. "There's my Is. Come sit on Papa's lap while I write your Maman a poem." Or maybe she had imagined that memory, constructed it from the threads of her own need, and wrapped it tightly around her shoulders. She didn't know anymore. Now it was Germans who crowded into the shadowy nooks and crannies. In the 6 weeks since Isabel had reopened the shop, word had apparently spread among the soldiers that a pretty French girl could be found often at the shop's counter. They arrived in a stream, dressed in their spotless uniforms, their voices loud as they jostled one another. Isabel flirted with them mercilessly, but made sure never to leave the shop until it was empty. And she always left by the back door, wearing a charcoal cloak with the hood drawn up, even in the heat of summer. The soldiers might be jovial and smiling, boys really, who talked of pretty fräuleins back home and bought French classics by acceptable authors for their families, but she never forgot that they were the enemy. "Mademoiselle, you are so beautiful, and you are ignoring us. How will we survive?" a young German officer reached for her. She laughed prettily and pirouetted out of his reach. "Now, monsieur, you know I can show no favorites." She sidled into place behind the sales counter. "I see you are holding a book of poetry. Certainly you have a girl back home who would love to receive such a thoughtful gift from you." His friends shoved him forward, all of them talking at once. Isabel was taking his money when the bell above the front door tinkled gaily. Isabel looked up, expecting to see more German soldiers, but it was Anouk. She was dressed as usual, more for her temperament than the season, in all black, a fitted V-neck black sweater and straight skirt with a black beret and gloves. A Galois cigarette hung from her bright red lips, unlit. She paused in the open doorway with a rectangle of the empty alley behind her, a flash of red geraniums and greenery. At the bell, the Germans turned. Anouk let the door shut behind her. She casually lit her cigarette and inhaled deeply. With half of the store length between them and three German soldiers milling about, Isabel's gaze caught Anouk's. In the weeks that Isabel had been a courier, she'd gone to Blois, Lyon, and Marseille, to Amboise and Nice, not to mention at least a dozen drops in Paris recently, all under her new name, Juliette Gervais, using false papers that Anouk had slipped her one day in a bistro, right under the Germans' noses. Anouk had been her most frequent contact, and even with their age difference, which had to be at least a decade, maybe more, they had become friends in the way of women who live parallel lives, wordlessly but no less real for its silence. Isabel had learned to see past Anouk's dour expression and flat mouth, to ignore her taciturn demeanor. Behind all that, Isabel thought there was sadness, a lot of it, and anger. Anouk walked forward with a regal, disdainful air that cut a man down to size before he even spoke. The Germans fell silent, watching her, moving sideways to let her pass. Isabel heard one of them say, "Mannish," and another, "Widow." Anouk seemed not to notice them at all. At the counter, she stopped and took a long drag on her cigarette. The smoke blurred her face, and for a moment only her cherry-red lips were noticeable. She reached down for her handbag and withdrew a small brown book. The author's name, Baudelaire, was etched into the leather, and although the surface was so scratched and worn and discolored, the title was impossible to read. Isabel knew the volume, Les Fleurs du Mal, The Flowers of Evil. It was the book they used to signal a meeting. "I am looking for something else by this author," Anouk said, exhaling smoke. "I am sorry, madame. I have no more Baudelaire. Some Verlaine, perhaps, or Rimbaud?" "Nothing, then." Anouk turned and left the bookshop. It wasn't until the bell tinkled that her spell broke and the soldiers began speaking again. When no one was looking, Isabel palmed the small volume of poetry. Inside of it was a message for her to deliver, along with the time it was to be delivered. The place was as usual, the bench in front of the Comédie Française. The message was hidden beneath the end papers, which had been lifted and re-glued dozens of times. Isabel watched the clock, willing the time to advance. She had her next assignment. At precisely 6 p.m., she herded the soldiers out of the bookshop and closed up for the night. Outside, she found the chef and owner of the bistro next door, Monsieur Dupart, smoking a cigarette. The poor man looked as tired as she felt. She wondered sometimes, when she saw him sweating over the fryer or shucking oysters, how he felt about feeding Germans. "Bonsoir, monsieur," she said. Bonsoir, mademoiselle. Long day, she commiserated. Oui. She handed him a small used copy of Fables for his children. For Jacques and Gigi, she said with a smile. One moment. He rushed into the cafe and returned with a small, grease-stained sack. Frites, he said. Isabel was absurdly grateful. These days she not only ate the enemy's leftovers, she was thankful for them. Merci. Leaving her bicycle in the shop, she decided to ignore the crowded, depressingly silent metro and walk home, enjoying the greasy, salty frites on her way. Everywhere she looked, Germans were pouring into cafes and bistros and restaurants, while the ashen-faced Parisians hurried to be home before curfew. Twice along the way, she had a niggling sense that she was being followed, but when she turned, there was no one behind her. She wasn't sure what brought her to a halt on the corner near the park, but all at once she knew that something was wrong, out of place. In front of her, the street was full of Nazi vehicles honking at one another. Somewhere, someone screamed. Isabel felt the hairs on the back of her neck raise. She glanced back quickly, but no one was behind her. Lately, she often felt as if she were being followed. It was her nerves working overtime. The golden dome of the Invalides shone in the fading rays of the sun. Her heart started pounding. Fear made her perspire. The musky, sour scent of it mingled with the greasy odor of frites, and for a moment her stomach tilted uncomfortably. Everything was fine. No one was following her. She was being foolish. She turned onto Rue de Grenelle. Something caught her eye, made her stop. Up ahead, she saw a shadow where there shouldn't be a shadow. Movement where it should be still. Frowning, she crossed the street, picking her way through the slow-moving traffic. On the other side, she moved briskly past the clot of Germans drinking wine in the bistro toward an apartment building on the next corner. There, hidden in the dense shrubbery beside an ornate set of glossy black doors, she saw a man crouched down behind a tree in a huge copper urn. She opened the gate and stepped into the yard. She heard the man scramble backward, his boots crunching on the stones beneath him. Then he stilled. Isabel could hear the Germans laughing at the cafe down the street, yelling out, "Sictel, s'il vous plaît," to the poor, overworked waitress. It was the supper hour, the one hour of the day when all the enemy cared about was entertainment and stuffing their stomachs with food and wine that belonged to the French. She crept over to the potted lemon tree. The man was squatted down, trying to make himself as small as possible. Dirt smeared his face, and one eye was swollen shut, but there was no mistaking him for a Frenchman. He was wearing a British flight suit. "Mon Dieu," she muttered. "Anglais?" He said nothing. "RAF," she said in English. His eyes widened. She could see him trying to decide whether to trust her. Very slowly, he nodded. "How long have you been hiding here?" After a long moment, he said, "All day." "You'll get caught," she said, "sooner or later." Isabel knew she needed to question him further, but there wasn't time. Every second she stood here with him, the danger to both of them increased. It was amazing that the Brit hadn't been caught already. She needed either to help him or to walk away before attention was drawn. Certainly walking away was a smart move. 57 Avenue de la Bourdonnais, she said quietly in English. "That's where I am going. In 1 hour I will go out for a cigarette. You come to the door then. If you arrive without being seen, I will help you. You understand me? How do I know I can trust you?" She laughed at that. "This is a foolish thing I am doing, and I promised not to be so impetuous." "Ah, well." She pivoted on her heel and left the garden area, clanging the gate shut behind her. She hurried down the street. All the way home, her heart was pounding, and she second-guessed her decision. But there was nothing to do about it now. She didn't look back, not even at her apartment building. There, she stopped and faced the big brass knob in the center of the oak door. She felt dizzy and headachy. She was so scared. She fumbled with the key in the lock and twisted the knob and surged into the dark, shadowy interior. Inside, the narrow lobby was crowded with bicycles and hand carts. She made her way to the base of the winding stairway and sat on the bottom step, waiting. She looked at her wristwatch 1,000 times, and each time she told herself not to do this. But at the appointed time, she went back outside. Night had fallen. With the blackout shades and unlit street lamps, the street was as dark as a cave. Cars rumbled past, unseen without their headlamps on, heard and smelled but invisible unless an errant bit of moonlight caught them. She lit her brown cigarette, took a deep drag, and exhaled slowly, trying to calm herself. "I'm here, miss." Isabel stumbled backward and opened the door. "Stay behind me, eyes down, not too close." She led him through the lobby, both of them banging into bicycles, clanging them and rattling wooden carts. She had never run up the 5 flights of stairs faster. She pulled him into her apartment and slammed the door shut behind him. "Take off your clothes," she said. "Pardon me?" She flicked on the light switch. He towered over her. She saw that now. He was broad-shouldered and skinny at the same time, narrow face with a nose that looked like it had been broken a time or two. His hair was so short it looked like fuzz. "Your flight suit. Take it off. Quickly." What had she been thinking to do this? Her father would come home and find the airmen and then turn them both to the Germans. Where would she hide his flight suit? And those boots were a dead giveaway. He bent forward and stepped out of his flight suit. She had never seen a grown man in his undershorts and T-shirt before. She felt her face flush. "No need to blush, miss," he said, grinning as this were ordinary. She yanked his suit into her arms and held out her hand for his identification tags. He handed them over, 2 small discs worn around his neck. Both contained the same information: Lieutenant Torrance McLeish, his blood group and religion and number. "Follow me, quietly. What's the word on the edges of your toes?" "Tiptoes," he whispered. She led him to her bedroom. There, slowly, gently, she pushed the armoire out of the way and revealed the secret room. A row of glassy doll eyes stared back at her. "That's creepy, miss," he said, "and it's a small space for a big man. Get in. Stay quiet. Any untoward sound could get us searched. Madame Leclerc next door is curious and could be a collaborator. You understand? Also, my father will be home soon. He works for the German High Command." "Blimey!" She had no idea what that meant, and she was sweating so profusely her clothes were starting to stick to her chest. What had she been thinking to offer this man help? "What if I have to, you know?" he asked. "Hold it." She pushed him into the room, giving him a pillow and blanket from her bed. "I'll come back when I can. Quiet, oui?" He nodded. "Thank you." She couldn't help shaking her head. "I'm a fool, a fool." She shut the door on him and shoved the armoire back into place, not quite where it went, but good enough for now. She had to get rid of his flight suit and tags before her father came home. She moved through the apartment on bare feet, as quietly as possible. She had no idea if the people downstairs would notice the sound of the armoire being moved or too many people moving about up here. Better safe than sorry. She jammed the flight suit in an old Samaritan department store bag and crushed it to her chest. Leaving the apartment felt dangerous suddenly. So did staying. She crept past the Leclerc apartment and then rushed down the stairs. Outside, she drew in a gulping breath. Now what? She couldn't throw this just anywhere. She didn't want someone else to get in trouble. For the first time, she was grateful for the city's blackout conditions. She slipped into the darkness on the sidewalk and all but disappeared. There were few Parisians out this close to curfew, and the Germans were too busy drinking French wine to glance outside. She drew in a deep breath, trying to calm down, to think. She was probably moments away from curfew, although that was hardly her biggest problem. Papa would be home soon. The river. She was only a few blocks away, and there were trees along the quay. She found a smaller, barricaded side street and made her way to the river, past the row of military lorries parked along the street. She had never moved so slowly in her life, one step, one breath at a time. The last 50 feet between her and the banks of the Seine seemed to grow and expand with each step she took. And then again, as she descended the stairs to the water. But at last she was there, standing beside the river. She heard boat lines creaking in the darkness, waves slapping their wooden hulls. Once again, she thought she heard footsteps behind her. When she stilled, so did they. She waited for someone to come up behind her, for a voice demanding her papers. Nothing. She was imagining it. She threw the bag into the black water and then hurled the identification tags in after it. The dark, swirling water swallowed the evidence instantly. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.